All right. We have already talked about the citric acid cycle, which we're seeing in 7 in greater detail. This shows you the fine details, which, you know, I want you to memorize all these atoms and their positions, but you can see what's happening here as a summary of as a review of what we've already talked about. First, before the citric acid cycle, remember you have the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. That sends the 2-carbon acetyl group to coenzyme A, which carries it as acetyl coenzyme A to the citric acid cycle. The 4-carbon oxaloacetate receives that acetate from acetyl coenzyme A. That converts it into a 6-carbon compound for which the cycle is named. That makes citrate or citric acid. Then it just gets isomerized. There's nothing energetically interesting happening here. It just rearranges the atoms into isocitrate so that it can now work in the first oxidative decarboxylation step. There are 4 oxidation steps, 2 of which are oxidative decarboxylations. So notice that this is the first time when you're now breaking down that carbon skeleton that was 6 carbons coming in, transforming it from isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate. Notice there's now just 5 carbons, and that's why it spits off a carbon dioxide. But it's an oxidative decarboxylation because you strip the fuel of hydrogen, which gets stuck onto NAD+, reducing it in NADH. The next step is the other oxidative decarboxylation. So when alpha-ketoglutarate gets transformed into succinyl coenzyme A, that involves the removal of a 2nd carbon, the final carbon that's going to be removed, because these two carbon dioxides plus the one that was removed from the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate completely dismantles those 3 carbons that came in as pyruvate. The same thing's happening to the other pyruvate. So the glucose is totally dismantled now, nothing but carbon dioxide at this point. But you make another NADH because it's an oxidative decarboxylation. And then you have just a few more steps left to get some more energy out of it in the form of oxidation steps and in the form of a phosphorylation step that allows you to make ATP. But in the process, that's going to regenerate the original receiver. The start-finish line is oxaloacetate. Well, these remaining steps not only get more energy out of it, out of the molecule, and make ATP, but they reform the thing you need to have to receive 2 more carbons in the form of acetate being carried by coenzyme A to make it a cycle and start over again. By the way, this slide shows you what's happening in us animals. I already talked about the fact that in non-animals, the step right here would be a direct formation of ATP via substrate-level phosphorylation. But in us, what directly gets phosphorylated is GDP, making it into GTP, but that immediately drops its phosphate off to an ADP to make it into ATP. So it's just a little bit different way of doing the same thing in the end. So that gets us to succinate. That ATP is ready to go. Like I say, all ATP is the goal in a sense. Succinate then undergoes the 3rd of the oxidative steps, but this one's not an oxidative decarboxylation. So we're already at 4 carbons. It's a matter of just rearranging those molecules to get it back to oxaloacetate. But along the way, we can oxidize it and get some more energy out of it. This is the first of those decarboxylations that are oxidative. Well, here is where we also involve the other kind of coenzyme, not NAD+, that is picking up these hydrogens, but FAD, flavin adenine dinucleotide, receives 2 electrons, 2 protons in the form of 2 hydrogen atoms from the fuel, and that reduces it into FADH2, which is this coenzyme's version of the reduced coenzyme. And then
fumarate gets transformed into malate. That's just an isomerization. And then finally, in the final step, not only do you get back to oxaloacetate, which you need to complete the cycle so that it can receive more carbons coming in, but that's the final oxidative step. So once again, you strip the fuel of hydrogen and stick it on to NAD plus again, making NADH. Therefore, the cycle completes the oxidation of the fuel, completes the dismantling of the carbon skeleton, gets all the usable energy out of what fuel was remaining when it came in as pyruvate, and makes a little bit of ATP via substrate level phosphorylation, but by far most of the energy that's been extracted by the citric acid cycle is in the form of reduced coenzymes. Three additional NADHs. I say additional because we made some in glycolysis, remember, and we also made some in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate right before this cycle. Three of those, though, NAD plus NADHs, and also, importantly, an FADH2. Now, FADH2 is carrying a lot of energy, but not as much energy as NADH and H plus are carrying. And therefore, in terms of the final payoff, what I'm trying to say here is FADH2 can't lead to as many ATPs being produced eventually as an NADH molecule can. But it's carrying more than an ATP does. Okay, now to 8. This is just a schematic representation of the other coenzyme involved, namely flavin adenine dinucleotide, and very similar, not surprisingly, to how nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide is formed, except instead of having nicotinamide as the nitrogenous base, it has flavin. Riboflavin specifically is the business end of this flavin adenine dinucleotide, because it's the part, just like nicotinamide is in the other one, that is able to receive the electrons to become reduced. So just like the other one, there's an oxidized form and a reduced form. But notice that it's not FAD plus. It's NAD plus in the oxidized form. And that's why it receives two electrons and just one proton, right? Because one of that first electron just makes it NAD without a charge. And then an additional electron and proton make it NADH, like I was talking about. Well, in the oxidized form of the flavin adenine dinucleotide, there is no charge to begin with. So it can receive two electrons and two protons. In other words, two full hydrogen atoms, which is why the reduced form is not FADH and H plus, it's FADH2. Right? Does that make sense? Both of those hydrogens come from the fuel via dehydrogenation reaction. Well, another look in slide 9 at the citric acid cycle and what comes before, which is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. The point here is not the details of the individual reactions. The point here is how this is controlled allosterically. Just like we talked about for glycolysis and gluconeogenesis, there are particular steps in this pathway that are important control points that allow the cell to turn up or turn down the pathway, to let it work or not. It needs to be controlled, right? But not every single enzyme is a major control point. Some of them just run if the step in front of them is running. They'll just run automatically if they're fed with their substrate. But the important control points are highlighted here. First of all, one important control point is the enzyme complex that catalyzes the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. That's a huge protein complex. It's not a single polypeptide.
but it's working as an enzyme complex, and it's called pyruvate dehydrogenase complex, or just pyruvate dehydrogenase. It's big, though. Anyway, when that is an active enzyme complex, it does its job of oxidatively decarboxylating pyruvate and turning it into acetyl coenzyme A, right? And producing CO2. Therefore, to control whether that happens, to control the use of pyruvate as a fuel, to oxidize that as a fuel is to use it, to control that happening, the enzyme gets turned on or off. And so pyruvate dehydrogenase has as a switch the typical situation, a phosphate. This is a major way in which enzymes in general can be controlled by either phosphorylating them or dephosphorylating. And you can't say that phosphorylation always turns one on and dephosphorylation always turns it off. It depends on the specific enzyme. So notice that in the phosphorylated state, pyruvate dehydrogenase is in the inactive form. So it has to be, it's an example of one that has to be dephosphorylated in order to activate it, which will turn on cellular respiration, this part of cellular respiration. Okay? So what kind of secondary enzyme is in charge then of turning this thing on? Not a kinase. A phosphatase, right, because you have to remove a phosphate to activate pyruvate dehydrogenase. And so there is an enzyme, notice it's called PDH phosphatase, because it dephosphorylates PDH. It's not PDH itself, it dephosphorylates PDH. And PDH is pyruvate dehydrogenase. All right? Antagonistically, there is a third enzyme. The kinase, PDH kinase, which can turn it back off by sticking a phosphate back onto it. So that's a major control point. And look at the signals, make sense of these signals that are working here. If you have acetyl coenzyme A in abundance, or if you have NADH in abundance, or if you have ATP in abundance. If these things are building up, that's a sign that you don't need to continue running cellular respiration, right? You have enough already. And therefore, they act as inhibitors. That's why they have negative signs on them. They inhibit pyruvate dehydrogenase and therefore shut off the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. They shut down cellular respiration. The opposites of those are if you have coenzyme A, the empty version, just coenzyme A, not acetyl coenzyme A. If you have a bunch of that, or if you have a bunch of NAD+, the oxidized form, or if you have a bunch of AMP, which means spent ATP, right? Those are signals that you need to run cellular respiration to replenish the ATP, to reduce the coenzyme, and to pick up the acetate by coenzyme A. So those all stimulate. Well, major control points in the citric acid cycle are also highlighted here. Isocitrate dehydrogenase is the name for the enzyme that transforms isocitrate into alpha-ketoglutarate. That's the first of the oxidative decarboxylations that I was just talking about in the citric acid cycle. All right, that's a major control point. NADH in abundance turns it down too, right? ADP... it's another form of spent ATP, right? That will ramp it up. If you have a bunch of ADP, that means you don't have very much ATP, so you need to run this thing. The second one that is an oxidative decarboxylation is another important control point. That enzyme is alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase. Notice that they're both dehydrogenases. That's why it's oxidative decarboxylation. These point to the fact that it's oxidative, not that it's decarboxylation, but it's oxidative. You're stripping the hydrogens. Those hydrogens are what get put onto the oxidized coenzyme to reduce them. Okay? Anyway, notice the signals and make sense of those. The third major control point in the citric acid cycle is the final one that regenerates oxaloacetate out of malate, which is that final oxidative step. That's malate dehydrogenase. Once again, another dehydrogenase, because what we're doing really is picking off hydrogens from the fuel and sticking them onto the oxidized coenzymes to make them into the reduced coenzymes. That's where most of the energy is at this point. Most of the usable energy that was originally in glucose is in the form of several different NADHs plus a couple FADH2s. Why two FADH2s? No. There's two pyruvates from that one glucose. Remember, you're running all this in double. Everything after the fork in the road in glycolysis has to be doubled, because when you split that six-carbon compound into two three-carbon compounds, everything happens for each of those two three-carbon compounds. All right, so now we have invested the usable energy other than the couple ATP that we've made. We've invested the usable energy at this point in reduced coenzymes. That's where our fuel energy is at the moment. Some of that came from glycolysis, because we made some NADH there. Some of it in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Most of it in the citric acid cycle. But those are all sources of energy. Now it's time for the third phase of cellular respiration, which is what? Electron transport is one aspect of the third phase. Chemiosmosis is another aspect of the third phase. What do we call the combination of electron transport and chemiosmosis? Oxidative phosphorylation, yes. That's the third major step. And slide 10 shows you a major player in this game. This thing is called either ubiquinone, which is so named because of its ubiquity. Being ubiquitous means found everywhere. But it's also called coenzyme Q. So CoQ, coenzyme Q, ubiquinone, those all mean the same thing. Look, though, at the figure, and you'll see that there are three forms of this energy-carrying molecule. So this is another coenzyme, right? NAD, FAD are both coenzymes. They carry energy. Well, so does coenzyme Q. But there are three forms instead of just two, like there are for FAD and NAD. This thing can be sequentially reduced. All right? So it can receive a hydrogen atom, which is represented by a proton and an electron as separate particles, right? But that's a hydrogen atom that's coming from somewhere. And that will transform ubiquinone, which is the completely oxidized form, into this intermediate form, which is semiquinone. By the way, this whole thing is an example of a quinone. It's not the only quinone, but that's why that's in all of these names. Ubiquinone is the oxidized form. Semiquinone is the partially reduced form. It has been reduced with just one hydrogen. Look up at CoQ, the ubiquinone, the oxidized form. Notice that there are two carbonyls in that. And those oxygens of the carbonyls, one on top, one on the bottom, are the places where hydrogens can be added. This is the site of reduction. So semiquinone has one of those former carbonyls, this bottom one, reduced here. You still have another one you can work with, though. And therefore, it can receive another electron and proton or hydrogen atom. And that transforms it into the fully reduced form, which is either symbolized CoQH2 or it's called dihydroquinone. Notice that semiquinone is CoQH. So the symbols make sense too, right? CoQ doesn't have any H on it, so that's the fully oxidized form. CoQH, partially reduced. CoQH2, fully reduced. And this is I said it's a major player in the game. The game, what I'm talking about, is really the electron transport chain or the electron transport system. There's not just one chain. There's many, many copies of it operating in the mitochondria. And where specifically does electron transport take place? In the mitochondria, yes, but where specifically? Inner membrane, correct. So the members of what we call the electron transport chains, of which CoQ is one, those are components of the inner mitochondrial membrane. They're parts of that membrane. In 11, we're looking at the members of this chain in a form that also serves as a graph. This E-naught prime that we see on the y-axis, that's the symbol for what's called the reduction potential. When you're talking about reduction potentials, this is involving what are called redox pairs. For instance, NAD plus and NADH are a redox pair. There's an oxidized form and a reduced form, and it can go from one to the other. Okay. Reduction potential refers to how willing a redox pair is to give up its... how willing the reduced version of a redox pair is to give up its electron to some other redox pair. Okay? And the higher it is on this graph, notice that this graph gets more and more negative as we go up, which is the opposite of the normal situation. The more negative this value, the more likely this a redox pair is to give its electron up to another redox pair below it. This is the essence of how the electron transport chain works. It's several different redox reactions in sequence. What's happening is that something is going to receive electrons, and by virtue of that is going to become reduced. But it's going to that already reduced thing is then going to send that electron off to something else and reducing it, reoxidizing itself. Okay? Well, the thing that it's going to send its electrons to is going to be something that's lower on this graph. That has, in other words, that has a more positive reduction potential. The more positive the reduction potential, which is lower in this graph, the more greedily grabbing for the electrons that thing is. And bottom on the list here, bottom of the figure, is oxygen. This is why oxygen serves well as a final electron acceptor, because it has a high reduction potential. It wants those electrons. And what is the reduced form of oxygen? It involves oxygen and hydrogen, but there are two hydrogens. Water, right. This is why water is a product. It's on the product side of the overall summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose, right? You start with glucose and oxygen. Those are the needs. And through many steps that we've been talking about, you transform that into carbon dioxide, which came from the glucose, and water, which came from the oxygen after it receives hydrogens from that glucose. Okay? So this is why the electron transport chain works. Each member passes its electrons that it just received off to something that has an even higher reduction potential than itself. And so stepwise, every time there's a passage of electron from one member to the next, a little bit of energy is released. If you just burn glucose, combust it, you know, just put a match to it, you'll do this all in one big step and produce carbon dioxide, and oxygen will get reduced into water. So you produce exactly the two same things if you just burn glucose. But that releases that energy all at once, which is why a hell of a lot of heat is produced, which would kill the cell. And it also, not only that, even if it survived it, it wouldn't put to use that released energy. You wouldn't be able to make any ATP out of it. The electron transport chain allows these electrons to go a little bit lower in energy each time they're passed down, releasing that energy in manageable steps that can be used to do some work. And what is the form of work that the electron transport chain accomplishes? The pumping of protons to produce, yes, a proton gradient. So these complexes are called complexes because they're not single proteins. Most of them are proteins, except for coenzyme Q, which we just looked at. All of these are proteins or protein complexes. Cytochrome C is the smallest of these. Cytochrome C is a peripheral protein. And remember, peripheral proteins are just associated with one monolayer. It's also much smaller than the other complex, or than the true complexes here. And so cytochrome C is the most mobile. All of these things are able to move around in the membrane like any membrane component. But the large brown-shaded things here are the protein complexes. They're much bigger and much less mobile within the inner mitochondrial membrane. Cytochrome C, though, is like a little messenger boy moving freely from one complex to the next because it's a peripheral protein. These others are transmembrane proteins, complexes. Okay, so there are four overall protein complexes in a single electron transport chain. But remember, there are many copies of the chain within one mitochondrion. And they are named fairly reasonably complex 1, complex 2, complex 3, complex 4. At least that's one of their names each. Notice, though, that complex 1 and complex 2 both feed into the same place, kind of like a funnel. Both complex 1 and complex 2 are starting points, in a sense, because they receive electrons directly from reduced coenzymes that we've been talking about in the previous steps. In other words, NADH and FADH2. Those are the reduced coenzymes that we've produced. Well, NADH drops its electrons off to complex 1. FADH2 drops its electrons off to complex 2. In fact, it's actually part of complex 2. Okay? So those come from different places, but they both then, both complex 1 and complex 2, that is, send their electrons after having received them from the coenzymes to the same place, namely to coenzyme Q, ubiquinone. Okay? Another thing I should point out about these complexes is that although there are four complexes in an electron transport chain, three of them operate not only as electron acceptors and senders, but as pumps. This is what allows the energy that's released by sending the electrons from member to member to be used for work, because three of these complexes are powered by that release of energy by passing the electrons in order to pump protons. And those complexes that operate as pumps are complex 1, complex 3, and complex 4. Not complex 3. I mean, not complex 2, sorry. All right? Complex 2, by the way, is also a member of the citric acid cycle. Complex 2 is also called succinate dehydrogenase, and it's part of that citric acid cycle. Most of the reactions of the citric acid cycle occur in the mitochondrial matrix, but the succinate dehydrogenase step, if you go back and look at the whole cycle, that part is catalyzed by an enzyme that's actually embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane is complex 2. And you'll notice if you go back and find that succinate dehydrogenase enzyme in the cycle with the detail, that's the step where FAD receives two hydrogens to become FADH2. Okay, so that's occurring right there in complex 2. As far as the graph is concerned, the reason this works is because the passage is always going to a member that has a more positive, lower in the graph, reduction potential. And ultimately, the thing that receives the electrons is an external electron acceptor, which is why this is respiration. We're passing it off to something that's totally external to the process, oxygen that you're bringing in fresh each time. And it has a very much higher reduction potential than any member of the chain, and therefore will gladly take those electrons from the last member. Okay? And that transforms that oxygen into water. But the hydrogens that make up the water that you produce came from the glucose originally. Got picked off, passed around by coenzymes through the electron transport chain and then to water. Then to oxygen to make it into water. Okay. 12 shows you just the names of these things again. By the way, I didn't give you the other names of them. I should do that. The first enzyme... let me actually go through these with the previous slide because it's easier to make sense of for you. The first enzyme, notice, complex 1 enzymes complex, is called NADH coenzyme Q oxidoreductase, which seems like a complicated name, but this is exactly what this thing is doing, right? Every one of these complexes is an oxidoreductase because something is being oxidized, something is being reduced. By definition, when oxidation happens, reduction happens. Well, this one receives electrons from NADH and passes them on to coenzyme Q. That's why it's called that. All right. Similarly, complex 2, I told you, can be called succinate dehydrogenase, but it can also be called succinate coenzyme Q oxidoreductase. Okay? Or FAD coenzyme Q oxidoreductase is even another name. Complex 3 receives things from CoQ and sends them on to cytochrome C, so it's called coenzyme Q cytochrome C oxidoreductase. And complex 4 receives them from cytochrome C, passes them on to oxygen, so it's just called cytochrome C oxidase. All right. So the names hopefully make sense. In slide 12's table, we can see the sizes of these things. Notice that, for instance, the complex 1 consists of 43 polypeptides, not 43 amino acids, 43 individual polypeptides. So it's a huge protein complex. The numbers in parentheses, by the way, are the number of polypeptides that are coded for by genes of the mitochondrion. Remember that the mitochondrion has its own DNA. So some of these things are coded for by the mitochondrion itself. Anyway, this just puts it into table form what I've already, the rest of it I've pretty much already described, so there's not new information there. Let's look at another cartoon form in slide 13. This shows you the actual complexes as they're embedded in the membrane. And notice that cytochrome C is fairly mobile, as is coenzyme Q. Coenzyme Q is, remember, not actually a protein. It's a quinone. Cytochrome C is a protein, but it's much smaller than these protein complexes. Anyway, the three brown ones shown here, complex 2 is not shown here. This just shows you 1, 3, and 4, the three that operate as pumps. Remember, complex 2 does not operate as a pump. So, NAD is coming in, and there are the several sources of that NAD, right? Citric acid cycle, oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, and glycolysis. They all make equally valuable NADH. It dumps its electrons off, you know, gets rid of its passengers from its taxi onto complex 1. That pumps some protons, and the direction of the pumping, importantly, is from the matrix. They're taken from the matrix, in other words, these hydrogen ions, and pumped through the inner membrane into the intermembrane space, the compartment between the outer and the inner membrane. That means there's an accumulation of protons in the intermembrane space, which means the pH there is what, relatively? No. Which means what? Lower pH, right. The intermembrane space is accumulating protons, it's becoming more acidic. On the pH scale, that means lower value than the matrix. Well, complex 1 just passes its electrons off to coenzyme Q, reducing it, right? The reduced form of coenzyme Q, CoQH2 in other words, dumps its electrons off to complex 3, which will then, after it dumps them off to cytochrome C, get the power to pump more protons, adding to the gradient. Cytochrome C picks up the electrons from complex 3 and delivers them to complex 4, reducing that thing. And then when it passes them off to oxygen, that provides still more power to pump more hydrogen ions. So all three of these are acting as pumps in the same direction. But the ultimate effect is that oxygen that we breathe receives electrons from the electron transport chain and protons from solution to turn it into water. And that is what makes it respiration. The fact that there's electrons passing along a membrane and there's an external electron acceptor. You're not just putting those electrons back onto a fuel like you did in fermentation, which is why it didn't get you any more ATP. It just allowed glycolysis to continue to happen. Now, that whole thing that I just described involving just the electron transport chain is electron transport, which is one part of oxidative phosphorylation. But now, the energy that was originally in glucose and that is has, other than that, lost as heat, which we can't do anything about, or the ATP that we've already made, which is ready to go, the energy now is not invested in reduced coenzymes because they've just been reoxidized by dumping them off to the electron transport chain, right? Now the form of energy, or the investment, is in the form of the proton gradient itself. But notice that this is why we don't need to bother with fermentation if we're undergoing cellular respiration. NADH now becomes NAD plus again. By dumping its electrons off to the electron transport chain, it can then drive back and pick up more electrons from more fuel. Now, if you didn't have fermentation, your total fleet of NADs would be in the form of NADH. If you have no empty taxis, everything previous would shut down. Even though glycolysis does not require oxygen, without oxygen to keep the electron transport chain running, the electron transport chain would fill up with electrons, couldn't receive any more from NADH, so all your taxis would be reduced. They'd be all full. And that means even the taxis that are necessary for glycolysis wouldn't be able to pick up any more electrons. So glycolysis would shut down. That's why in the case that happens, and cellular respiration can't operate, you have that second alternative, fermentation, to reoxidize your coenzymes. Okay, but anyway, this is the electron transport aspect of oxidative phosphorylation. It produces the proton gradient. That's where your energy is now. The final payoff is in the other aspect of oxidative phosphorylation, the part that is actually phosphorylation. The electron transport chain is oxidative, right? The production of ATP is the phosphorylating part of oxidative phosphorylation. And that involves this purple thing and many, many copies that are just like it that are in this membrane. This purple thing is called ATP synthase because it's able to synthesize, which means bring together, ADP and inorganic phosphate to make ATP. So that's the final payoff. This doesn't operate as an enzyme, though, if it is stationary. It has a stationary and a mobile component. Just like in an electric motor, there's a stator and a rotor. The stator is stationary. It doesn't move. The rotor rotates with respect to the stator. And only if that's happening does this thing actually work as an enzyme. But if that's happening, its effect is to bring inorganic phosphate and ADP together to form ATP. Well, what makes it spin is the diffusion of protons through the ATP synthase. So the ATP synthase is acting as a transport protein, but is also doing double duty as a phosphorylating enzyme. All right? And so this is completely analogous to the water wheel that I keep talking about. Instead of water, though, making it turn, what makes it turn is the diffusion of protons from the intermembrane space back into the mitochondrial matrix. Now, the fact that there's a gradient means protons want back into that matrix wherever they can get in. But why don't they go right through the phospholipid bilayer? Because they are a charged particle, right? They're small as hell, as small as you can get for a cation, right? A positive ion. They're the smallest possible one. But they're fully charged, so they don't easily go through the phospholipid bilayer. And therefore, the only place where they can easily get back into the matrix, down their gradient, is through ATP synthase molecules, and that causes them to spin. And therefore, that causes the oxidative phosphorylation of ATP, which is different from the substrate-level phosphorylation that we've used up to now to make those few ATP up to this point. Here's where, by far, most of the ATP will be produced from the energy that was originally in glucose. 14 is a slide that shows you what happens if you decouple electron transport from chemiosmosis. The chemiosmosis aspect refers to the diffusion of hydrogens through the ATP synthase, right? That's what actually causes the phosphorylation. Well, if you give hydrogen ions an even easier way to get back into the matrix, like through this thermogenin protein, which is acting just as a channel, basically, then the energy that you've invested in the form of this gradient will be spent just allowing diffusion to rapidly happen. This would be analogous to, instead of putting a AAA into something that you want to cause movement in, like a little motor, you just short it. You take a wire and connect the two ends. What's going to happen? Or the same thing can happen if you accidentally put it in a pocket full of change, because the change is metal. This is why you should never do that. If it makes a connection from the positive to the negative end of the AAA, it's just going to cause flow of electrons, and it's going to get very hot. You'll notice it in your pocket immediately. If it doesn't explode before you notice it. Well, that's what's happening here. This is allowing these protons to just trickle right back through to the matrix where they want to be, and that just builds up heat. But this is valuable sometimes. This is how brown adipose tissue in juvenile mammals, like baby humans or any other juvenile mammal, operates. They can produce heat just by uncoupling their electron transport from chemiosmosis. Instead of producing ATP, they use that gradient just to produce heat, and it will actually warm their body for that reason. Let's take a closer look now at the ATP synthase molecule, slide 15. There are, like I said, a stator and a rotor. The stator is the stationary component, but there are two parts to the stator and there are two parts to the rotor. There's an FO component overall and there's an F1 component. Well, there's an FO component to the stator And there's an F1 component to the stator as well. Similarly, there's an FO component to the rotor and an FO component to the, an F1 component to the rotor. That's why you have overall four descriptions here. The big difference here between FO and F1 is that the FO part is the part that's actually embedded in the membrane, whereas the F1 part is sticking out into the matrix. It's not actually directly touching the membrane. But there's many different proteins involved here. These protein subunits or polypeptides give letter names. So you have a bunch of C's, you have an A, a B. You also have alpha, beta, delta, gamma, and epsilon. All right? Well, the stator part, the part that stays stationary, consists of the A and the B's. And also this delta part on the bottom. And everything else rotates with respect to that. So all these C's that are forming a ring, that ring rotates with respect to the A subunit of the stator. Okay? And what causes that rotation is diffusion of hydrogen ions through this ring. But C ring is connected to the epsilon and gamma stalk of the rotor that is then connected, that is in turn connected to this catalytic knob, as it's called, at the bottom, made up of alpha and beta subunits, three alphas and three betas. Okay? Three alphas and three betas. So there's six parts to this catalytic knob. And it turns because it's connected to the shaft, which is in turn connected to the C ring. All right? Let's look at how this works. Slide 16. We're looking at the end, an end view of that catalytic knob. And the alphas aren't shown here, even though they're there. I said it was three alphas and three betas. It's the betas, though, that are actually working as enzymes. Therefore, the alphas aren't shown just for simplicity. Now, the three betas are identical to each other, but they all, each one of them can undergo shape changes. And so there are three different shapes that each beta can be in at any given moment. And those are represented as O, L, and T. O for open, the open conformation. L for loose, the loose conformation. And T for tight. So each of these three betas goes through all three conformations over and over as the rotor turns. Okay, so it'll be in the open shape first, then it'll be its shape will change into the loose conformation, which will then change into the tight conformation. It does that as it turns because of its interaction with the gamma that you see right in the middle. It's a protein that is interfering, it's interacting with the beta in a different way depending on which side of that gamma the beta is on. So with each rotation of this whole rotor, a beta is going to go from open to loose to tight. The other two betas are doing the same thing, but since there are three betas, one of them is going to be in the open, one of them is going to be in the loose, and one of them is going to be in the tight conformation at the same time. Then the open is going to change to loose, the tight is going to change to open, the loose is going to change to tight with each turn. Does that make sense? So let's look at it on the top. Paying attention to that top gamma. It's in the open conformation. That means that it's able now to receive its two substrates, ADP and inorganic phosphate. Because of the openness, those can come in there and bind very, very loosely to the active site. They're actually not even bound yet. They're just there. But this stalk is turning. So when it turns, this open conformation beta is going to get changed into the loose conformation beta. which allows now for the ADP and the inorganic phosphate to bind. It's loosely bound, though, meaning that it's not bound tightly enough for the two to react with each other and become ATP. With the next part of the rotation, though, it's going to transform that same beta into the tight conformation, and that's when ADP and inorganic phosphate actually become ATP. Well, on the next bit of turn, that tight one is going to be now in the open form, and that's when the ATP gets released. And it's then now able to accept another ADP and inorganic phosphate for another round. The same exact thing is happening in the other two betas. It's just that they're in a different state compared to that one beta. But it's the same cycle over and over. Okay, I'll stop there.